room.
Is this better?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought it was because I was sitting farther back.
Yeah, that's probably what it is, Bruce. You're sitting farther back. Let me get the microphone a little closer. It's more sensitive than the one that I wear, but it's also a lot less trouble. I don't get all the tape on my face and all the other problems I get with the other one. So this is better. Hopefully, well, just remind me or do this. If I turn away and it doesn't work, let me just start by thanking everybody for coming. I also want to thank Wade in particular.
Please, with the accolades.
I know. And is he going to be able to get out of his head out the door?
Oh,
but as I've said many times, people who don't teach don't really understand what it is to prepare and to stand up here, whatever, for an hour and talk. And I know the same with me as with Wade. The more you prepare to teach, the more you learn yourself about yourself and about the Lord. And you share out of that, but we are the ones that get the most benefit out of it. And I listened to both of Wade's sermonettes, and they were wonderful.
We did.
Well, I do have them online, so if I'll send out a note and tell you how to get to them. I did add on the if you go to the website and you go to lessons and you go to the right hand side of the page, about halfway down, I've got a little thing that says private page, and that's where I've got Linda Stewart's, and I've got some of the testimonies that have been done, some of the ones that have been recorded I have there, so you'll be able to listen to those if you will. And Wade's, both of them are there, so you'll be able to listen to that. And you know, he did the 24th and the 1st. We're going to just continue in Daniel, you know, for the foreseeable future. But before we get too far into that, I want to talk about a couple things. One of them is Vicky's at home with COVID, as you know. She tested Monday, and her COVID line was bright. She tested yesterday morning and her COVID line was there, but it was very dim. And her 5 days is up by the end of the day. So my suspicion is her infection is getting much better. She's under treatment. She's doing fine with that. And she's online now. So good morning. I've got everybody muted, though, so she can't respond unless she unmutes herself. Yeah, she can read my lips. Yeah, that's kind of a problem. But also,
tonight.
Yeah, I'll hear from her. Yeah, when I get home. The other thing I want to say is we had a great time. If any of you have never been on the Mississippi River from St. Louis to Minneapolis or to Red Wing, Minnesota, actually, the river is beautiful. I mean, it's so different from Mississippi down to New Orleans. You know, the Mississippi south of St. Louis has no locks on it, so it's much shallower and wider. And with some of the drought out there, the river is down a little bit, but the upper river is got, I don't know, 17 or 18 locks. So it's held up by the locks to be the right level. And it's wide and it's beautiful. And it's kind of a treacherous negotiation because the channel moves all over the river from one side to the other, in and out of islands. You see grass in the middle of the river with birds sitting there. So you know it's not deep, but it's beautiful. And you get up into unfamiliar territory for me, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And it's beautiful. Eagles everywhere. So, you know, great time. If you ever want to go on a paddle wheeler, it's Victorian era, perfectly finished. Food is great. People are wonderful. It's 7 miles an hour upstream. They run it 24 hours a day. It's smooth. It's wonderful, except for trains that run real close to the bank. Well, these aren't your trains. These are the noisy trains. Blow their whistles all night. But it's a wonderful trip. I would recommend it. The other thing I want to do before we get started is talk a little bit about Israel. I sent a note out yesterday. But there's two or three things that are really pretty interesting and really pretty disturbing about what's happening now. Not disturbing in the sense that we don't know what's going on, but disturbing in the sense that this is where we are. As you probably know from my note, at about 5:30 Sunday morning, Saturday morning, the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles holiday, Sabbath day, Israel was attacked by mostly Hamas. And they shot about 4,000 missiles over into Israel. But the difference this time was two things. One is Israel was not expecting it, which of course has been the history of these Yom Kippur wars and others, Israel caught by surprise, which I find a little bit interesting. But the second thing is the Iron Dome didn't work very well. They missed most of the missiles that came in. And what we understand is now it looks like they had some help in jamming the radars by somebody. And that somebody is most likely Russia, because nobody else really has that technology to do that. But America and Russia, and I don't think America's doing that to Israel. So at least I pray that's not the case. But anyway, I think it's probably Russia. The other thing that happened was a Israel tank inside their border had a bomb dropped on it from a drone. We don't think much about that, but that's also technology that nobody has except America and Russia. So somebody's been training these terrorists. And my guess is we're going to see a new chapter in the relationship between Israel and Russia. I'll also make the common point that Russia has been in constant communication with Iran, with Syria, where they are stationed, but also with Libya and with Sudan. And if you know anything about Bible prophecy in Ezekiel 28, the nations listed that come against Israel are exactly those nations. So it's kind of interesting to see all of that coming to pass. The other thing that was interesting to me is we got a note. We're signed up for what's called the STEP program, which is State Department for Early Warning of Activities. So Saturday afternoon, we got a warning about Israel. Glad you guys are back. We got a warning about Israel about terrorist activity near Gaza. And I didn't think much about it because it said, you know, just American embassies are not going to be sending anybody there. Travelers shouldn't be going there. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd. But then, of course, the next morning, Israel was attacked. So in my mind, I'm thinking, why did the U.S. know this? And why did not Israel know this? I don't know that. I would say this week is going to be a pretty profound week to understand more in depth what happened. But Israel was unprepared. And if you want to think about it this way, Israel always fights its battles at the edge of Israel. They intercept Syrians coming in. They intercept Gazans coming in. They, you know, they bomb in Libya. They bomb in other places to stop the flow. This time, the terrorists actually got inside of Israel and were knocking on doors and abducting and killing people, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles into Israel. And they got in there in two ways. One is they flew paragliders across the border and got in. I don't know why they weren't seen, except Iron Dome was disabled. Part of Iron Dome was disabled. And they used bulldozers to bulldoze the fence down, and motorcyclists, terrorists on motorcycles and cars, trucks came across the border. So it's almost like, you know, we fight terrorists over there, but just picture 1,000 terrorists showing up in Forsyth County and starting to knock on doors. That's kind of what Israel's facing. And, you know, they've got at least 100 people that have been captured and taken back to Gaza. They've had probably a couple of hundred killed, a lot of people wounded, 400 or 500 wounded. We don't really know the extent of it yet. And people are living in air raid shelters. Ben-Gurion Airport is closed to foreign flights. And what's happening is all Israeli citizens that are out of country are landing in Cyprus. And the Israeli military and El Al are picking him up there and making secure flights back into Israel to get him home. So it's kind of a tense situation. I would just tell you that Israel has already bombed the daylights out of Gaza, and they've dropped leaflets telling the people that if they're innocent, get out of town because we're going to level it. And they've gotten approval from the Knesset to start a ground war in Gaza. which if you know anything about house-to-house fighting, you know, the Marines did it in various places, and that will be a messy, messy situation. And I don't know what's happening. I'm sure Egypt is trying to broker things, but there's some rogue Egypt people that are also causing some trouble for Israel down on the side border. So I would just ask you to pray for Israel. Pray for, I mean, God is the God who never sleeps is guarding Israel. So we don't worry about them long term, but I do worry about the carnage that's going to happen there, and on both sides, honestly, because Israel will not take this lying down, and they've already started. And what was interesting is, you know, they've had all this turmoil in Israel, and people saying, well, we're not going to go to our post, we're Air Force people, and we're not going to fly planes, blah, blah, blah. Well, when this attack happened, people were leaving their houses and their cars and heading to their units all over Israel. So I think, if nothing else, this has galvanized the state of Israel to understand that some of the little petty squabbles they have are not anything compared to what's happening. And I would just say there's probably a lesson for us there. You know, we have a lot of petty squabbles going on in America. Some of them are all political. Yeah.
I was listening to Joe Rosenberg last night.
Yes.
He was saying that he thought that the Abraham Accords was going to extend into Saudi Arabia. And talks were already going on. And part of this is to prevent that from happening.
Well, and I think the that's a great point, because the Saudi Arabian deal, let's say, is pretty much in the bag, I would believe. They're all saying they want it. Israel wants it. Saudi wants it. America wants it. I mean, there's a few little sticking points, but nobody else, like Iran or Syria, other people don't want that, because they don't want any normalization with Israel. And so this attack may have been something to try to distract and derail that, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's going to proceed. That's got its own prophetic implications. Yes, question.
I have a friend. I went to Israel 25 years ago on a work project, and I made a friend with this woman, and I've kind of stayed in touch with her. So I reached out to her last night, and she just responded this morning. I'd love to read.
Yeah, please do.
She just said, "Dear Tina, it's so very nice and appreciated to hear from you, knowing you care and didn't forget. Hope all is well with you and your family. I'll always remember and cherish the good old times of your visits to Israel. Unfortunately, the situation here is really scary. It is so hard to know that there is such cruelty in this world. Unfortunately, although it is hard to admit, our country is surrounded with enemies whom for some reason want to eliminate us. Actually, the Israelis who live surrounding the Gaza Strip, where the massacre and kidnappings took place yesterday, face terror and rocket attacks on a daily basis for many, many years. We suffer from missile attacks from time to time." She lives in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
This time it is completely different. The situation has dramatically escalated. We can only put our trust in God, our military, government, and good friends around the world. Again, I really appreciate your message and love to hear how you're doing. So that's like, she had just sent that to me just now. So that's like a first-hand account.
And that's a common report, that even people in Tel Aviv, which is a long way away from Gaza, are feeling this, because of the terrorists have actually penetrated into Israel itself. And so it's going to be an interesting time. I mean, it's a time for prayer for Israel. It's a time for wise leadership, but it's also a time for America to engage. And we, I believe, have agreed to give them $80 or $90 billion worth of military equipment. I'm not sure what all that is, but I'm sure they're going to, maybe Patriot systems. I don't know what it is.
Jim, this is just another sign for us. It's a signpost on the end of the world, and encourage us to witness and evangelize. Even more.
Well, I think you're right. I think what this says is, and I tried to put in the note yesterday that I sent out, that this is one thing that's happening, but there are other things happening which are very prophetic. And, you know, we're all seeing if you read any news, you see floods in India, floods in Greece, floods everywhere, floods in Indonesia. You see volcanoes erupting, you see earthquakes, you see chaos everywhere, murder in the streets, anarchy in the streets, not just overseas somewhere, but actually here in America as well. And all of these things are predicted signs. None of them by themselves are really that significant. But one of the biggest signs, there's two big signs for the end times. One is the renewal of Israel, and that happened in 1948. So that's off the table now. The other one is that all of these signs that are predicted begin to happen like birth pains. In other words, they start converging. They begin to happen more frequently, more widespread, and more urgently. And that's what we're seeing now, is the convergence of all these signs. So I think, you know, God always warns us before he acts. And this is God saying, if you're awake and you're paying attention, you know, open your eyes and understand where we are.
Speaking of equipment, Israel has a stockpile of our supplies as far as equipment.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. But we also share technology with them for David Sling and for Iron Dome and a number of things that we partner. They've got a big military complex over there, and they partner with Raytheon and a few here for some special technology. And my guess is we're expediting some of that to them. Maybe some of the things we have, you know, we have a laser gun. I don't know if you've seen it or not. We have a laser gun that fires lasers about 5,000 a minute, and it takes out missiles. It takes out anything it sees. And we have not deployed that anywhere. It's only in test form here. I wouldn't be surprised to see that put in, because I don't care how many missiles you fire. If it takes out 5,000 a minute, you know, it's going to be very useful, and it'll be a great test for that. So I'm not predicting that. I just wouldn't be surprised if it's there. Plus a few other things like bunker busting bombs. I did notice that, didn't mean to spend this much time on this, but I did notice that Iran mysteriously had an explosion down in the bowels of their military where they produce missiles. So, Mossad may have missed the coming of this attack, but they're everywhere, and they at will, they can attack Iran wherever they are. I also wouldn't be surprised to see one morning we wake up and Israel has taken every naval ship that Iran has and put it on the bottom of the ocean. It wouldn't surprise me in the least. And that would be a big wake-up call, you know, for Iran. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I'm curious as a Christian about where we are. I'm thankful that God has told us what's going to happen. I'm thankful God has told us the end from the beginning. And I'm thankful that, you know, we are where we are now in the times. It's an exciting time to be, maybe a little uncomfortable for us. But as Christians, we need to get ready, and we need to make sure those that we love are getting ready, at least make the inroads to them. You just never know where that's going to be. So I think I'm going to finish on that. If you have questions, I'll be willing to answer anything you want to ask that I can on Israel. I would say if you're on Telegram and you sign up for Amir Sarfati, you'll get 50 emails a day of everything that's happening in Israel, you know, with video. He's very, very well connected to the IDF. He was in the IDF, very well connected. He's probably still a reservist. And he was in Fort Worth doing an evangelism talk. And so I saw a few minutes of a service this morning where he was giving an update on what's going on in Israel from his point of view. So I think it's kind of interesting to watch. So just watch the square. I'll be sending out stuff. I may talk a little bit more about it next week, because we may learn a whole lot more about what's going on in the next few days, because I can assure you Israel is digging deep into what happened and why they weren't prepared. That's not good. But this may be a pretty, I don't mean to make the death and stuff sound insignificant, but this may be a fairly good test for them to understand where their weaknesses are, and they can get them fixed before it gets super serious. It's serious now. But before we start, thank you for all of you who prayed for Tommy Chupp. His service was a very, very nice service. And Donna is off at a well-needed rest with her daughters up in the mountains somewhere. So she's taking time off. She's got to reschedule her hip surgery. She had to cancel it because it was the day of the funeral. But, you know, thank you for all of you, and all of you in particular, Gloria, Randy, and Deb, who made, organized, and got all the stuff together, and all of you who brought stuff, you know, and participated. I thank you for that. Just keep her in your prayers. Many of you know how it is to lose a spouse, and the times, the beginning times may be the toughest, because you have to get used to that. And it's going to be difficult. Several people have asked me about a prayer that I spoke at this, and I had a prayer that I've closed my talk with, and I put it up on the screen, but I'll read it to you. And I think it's a prayer. It's kind of interesting. We had on this river trip, we had a benediction service on Sunday morning, non-denominational, but very Jesus Christ oriented, which I'll say I was a little bit surprised at. But, you know, it wasn't First Redeemer Church, but there was no choir and there was no orchestra and there was no, you know, sermons at any biblical depth, but it was an evangelical service. And the guy closed it with a prayer that is sort of like an Irish prayer or a river prayer or something. And it says, "May God go before you to guide you, behind you to protect you, beside you to encourage you, above you to bless you, beneath you to uphold you, and within you to give you peace." I mean, that's to me, that's a really encompassing view of God's love in surrounding us in our time of need. So that's what that is. That'll be in the slides if you want it, or if you want to send me a note, I'll send it to you, you know, in printed format.
It also describes the Holy Spirit.
It does. It does. And I thought it was interesting in this service that they quoted this prayer. I've heard this before, but this was the first time I'd actually seen it used in really a non-denominational service. Of course, you don't have any idea who's on the boat. You know, you don't know what who's there, but this was a nice sermon, well-received and well-attended, I might add. There were 400 people on the boat, close to 400, I think. And there was probably at least 100 or 150 that got up and came to this service, which was pretty nice. They could have, you know, set up on the side and just watched the scenery or done anything else they wanted to do. So now I'm going to get into Daniel chapter 5. It's not a real long chapter. We should finish it today. But I want to cover a little bit about where we are, because it's been a while since we've talked. We've covered a lot of ground in Daniel, even though we've only covered four chapters. I'm going to do a chapter review real quickly, but we've seen Hebrew captives stand up and take their place, not give in to the pagan gods. We've seen God deliver the children of Israel, the three young Hebrew children, you know, out of the fiery furnace. We've seen God delivered them out of the hands of the king for the, you know, eating the king's table and eating the king's food. We've seen God reveal himself in ways that guarantee the message of Daniel that God is sovereign and God rules. That's a good message for us today as well, as we worry about Israel and we worry about America and we worry about where we're going as a country. We just have to remember that God is on his throne, God is in control. And whatever happens now, God is permitting to happen because it is in his plan. And he uses pagan men and women to do the work for him that he needs to have done. He used Nebuchadnezzar in this case. He may be using our government today. He may be using the World Health Organization. He may be using a lot of people to produce the outcome that he wants for us as children of the Lord, and also to advance the prophetic narrative that he set forward.
Even people on the boats.
Right. I mean, everywhere. It's kind of comforting, but it's one of those things that if you're not really in tune with God in control or God's sovereignty, you may just not think about it at all. It may just pass you by. We saw God in the last chapter, we saw God humble King Nebuchadnezzar. And that was a pretty powerful chapter. I mean, not just in the words, but the fact that God had rescued him, God had allowed him to prosper and given him plenty of opportunity to accept him, but he did not. And when he didn't, God finally brought him to his knees, to his 4 feet, literally, humbled him, and until he looked up, and until he acknowledged God to be sovereign. Then he restored him to his kingdom, which I thought was interesting. And today we're going to look at one of the first prophecies of the empires to be fulfilled. We're going to look at the setup for that, and that's chapter 5. So about 25 years have passed between chapter 4 and chapter 5. About 60 or 65 years altogether since the Hebrew children were captured. So Daniel is probably 70 to 75 years old at this time. And so he's lived his whole life, essentially, from a teenager to this point, under the captivity of the Babylonians, under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. And he's done very well. Nebuchadnezzar has now died. And in secular history, they talk about that, but Daniel doesn't include that in his narrative. But we know that's something that's happened. And finished his years in glory and in wealth because he had come to acknowledge the Lord. We asked the question whether he was really saved or not, and we don't know that answer, but I think in terms of the book of Daniel, it seems pretty obvious that he fully acknowledged God, and that's why he stayed to be effective for his whole time. But remember the prophecy of the statue. Remember that prophecy. The head of gold, the shoulders and arms of silver, the chest and breastplate of bronze, the waist and the legs of iron, and the feet of clay and iron mix. All of those are predictions of Gentile empires to come after Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, if you remember that. Daniel mentioned that to him. So all of that has happened. Now Nebuchadnezzar has passed away. And a really messy situation has occurred, Game of Thrones style, I guess. I don't watch Game of Thrones, but you know, if you ever read British monarch history or Russian czarist history, you know, they're brutal with each other. They kill each other. The nephews kill the uncles, and you know, it's brutal. Well, the same thing was happening in Babylon, you know, full of power, full of money, full of control. So Nebuchadnezzar died. He's succeeded by Merodach. My Bible calls him Evil Merodach. I don't know whether evil is an adjective or adverb to just describe him, but Merodach, who was his son. And then he was killed by his nephew, Nergal-Sarnessar. I can't pronounce all these, but you'll have to be. This is all out of secular history, by the way, not out of Daniel. He was succeeded by Nabonassarcod, whatever his name is, his son. But he was about 9 months old. So he succeeded as king, and he lasted for about a year until he was beaten to death by conspirators. But, you know, they did child sacrifice and everything else. So this was, you know, this was not an appalling fact to them. Nabonidus, who was one of the conspirators, became king, and he became king because he was probably married to a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar or to one of his hundreds of wives. The secular history is not clear. It's all kind of murky. But he is king now, and he's been king for about 17 years. But this is the time when the Persians begin to come after the Babylonians. And so I'll show you another map in a minute just to clarify the situation. But so Nabonidus is off fighting the Persians. He's got his army, he's off fighting the Persians. And his son, I think it's his son, Belshazzar, not Belteshazzar, but Belshazzar, is the third in line for the kingdom. So he is the son of the king. The king has actually been captured by the Persians at this time, but he doesn't know this. And so he is the second in command, and he's the acting king, if you will. Now, he lives in Babylon, and Babylon is a walled city. The Euphrates River comes right down through Babylon, and they've got walls that go down into the water to let the water in, but and to provide water for the city, but to not let anybody else. It's a secure city, high walls, thick walls, all guarded, and they're secure. So no matter what's happening in the kingdom, the city of Babylon is protected, or so they think. So he's acting as king, and while war is raging all around him, he decides to hold a banquet. Not unlike, you know, I'm sure that morale was down, so he decides to hold a big banquet in the city of Babylon. And all of this is murky, so I've given you what everybody believes is kind of accurate, but the word for son or father in Aramaic, there is no word for grandfather, by the way. So when they say son, just like in the New Testament and Old Testament, when they say, you know, Jesus is Abraham's or David's son, he's not really his son, but he's his ancestor. And so they look at ancestry as being a son of or a relative of. And so that complicates understanding exactly what's happened. But what I've given you, I think, is the best scenario to explain it. So here's the map. This is a map I showed before, and I'm just going to point out, here's Babylonia. Here's Babylon right on top of the river. Here's the Median Empire. This is Persia, or Elam, it's part of it's called at that time. But this is all Persia, and this is all under one governance. It's the Medo-Persian Empire. But as you see, there's a lot of little fiefdoms all around here, and this map doesn't show them all, but you know, the Kurds today are really the descendants of the Babylonians, which is kind of interesting. So they still occupy this part of Turkey and Iraq. And so they're being fought against by Syria. They're being fought against by Turkey. They don't want them to establish their own homeland, but they want their own homeland. And, you know, we've partnered with them because they're good fighters, and we use them to get rid of ISIS. We still partner with them over there. So it's a messy situation. It's all tribal, and it's not much different today than it was then. So the Medes and Persians are at the door, and the arm and chest of silver are about to take their place in the scheme of the empires replacing Babylon. But Belshazzar felt so secure that he was in a walled city with plenty of food, plenty of wine, plenty of everything he needed to be secure no matter what happened outside. And I would just say, as a matter of reference, Israel felt pretty secure with what was going on. They had their Iron Dome. They had their David sling. They had their powerful IDF. They had their Air Force. But yet, they were invaded. And it's kind of a wake-up call that history does repeat itself. And these Babylonians felt very secure. And so all of this is kind of the situation before we get to chapter 5. So in chapter 5, he thinks it's time for a celebration or a party. So let me start with chapter 5, and we'll just kind of read through it, and I'll comment as we go. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles, and he drank wine with them. So they had plenty of food and drink. 1,000 nobles. So these are the kind of the aristocracy of the Babylonian kingdom that are still holed up. They're not out fighting the war with Nabonidus. And while he's drinking his wine, this is mentioned several times. So what you get the clear picture of is he's had a lot of wine, and he begins to make some pretty bad decisions. He gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father here really means his ancestor, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. Now, let me say that Nebuchadnezzar, for all of these years, stole all of these implements, but he never desecrated them. He put them in a temple storehouse and preserved them in the condition they were in when they brought them from Jerusalem. Had he wanted to restore Jerusalem, those would have been able to be used in the Jerusalem temple because they had not been profaned. But Belshazzar calls for them to be retrieved, and he wants to drink wine out of them. But let me just say, who drinks wine out of them? So that the king, his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So he had, you know, he has the whole array of his harem there. And so they're all just drinking and eating away and having a grand old time. And that's bad enough. But what happens next is also bad. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple, and the king and nobles, wives and concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Babylon was a polytheistic society. They believed in multiple gods, you know, a god of stone. They were brick makers. They made a lot of bricks, and we talked about that. The city of Babylon was made out of fired bricks. So they had a great appreciation for that. And, you know, they had a god for everything. And so rather than praise the God of Israel, they praised the pagan gods. And Nebuchadnezzar has a sense, not Nebuchadnezzar, his heir, Belshazzar, has a sense that he's not doing right, because only under the influence of alcohol does he make this decision. And, you know, alcohol and drugs put people in a position where they make really stupid decisions. And this is no different. It's not something, a phenomenon for today. It's a phenomenon that's been going on ever since those things have been, you know, in play. So they bring them all in. Now what happens? Okay, suddenly, and I've got a little picture here. This is certainly not the picture, but it's a picture. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. So let me stop here for a second and just get you to picture something. They didn't have overhead lighting. They didn't have a lot of the things we take for granted today. You know, we go in a dark room, we want a lamp, we want a light, we want something we can see by. If we have to, we whip our phones out and turn the little light on to read a menu. Or, you know, on the ship, they had a lot of side lights, very few overhead lights. So when we got to the closet, we had to get our little phone out to see what was in the closet, you know, to wear. But that's pretty minor. But the way they lit the rooms was they had what's called lampstands. And lampstands were like a brass fixture with a hook on top. And they would hook an oil lamp in there, turn it up, and it would cast light in the room. We see that in Revelation when it talks about the lampstands in the five churches. But the light in Revelation is the light of God. It's not the light of oil lamps. This is the light of oil lamps. And you can imagine, if you've ever been in a situation where you're lit by a lantern, an oil lantern, not a gas lantern, the light flickers. The shadows appear. So this is a room where there's a plaster wall. Plaster was common in these days. There was a plaster wall. The light was right by the wall, and the hand appears. Not a human figure, but a hand. You know, and you can just picture a hand with fingers. And the king may be a little drunk. Yeah.
In just the right place.
In just the right place. And just the right time, it appears. Now, I don't know, he wrote with his finger probably. We see this also when you get back in Genesis and look at God, who writes the Ten Commandments. We see, you know, God writing the Ten Commandments. So this is a somewhat familiar biblical scene. But to this king, he may have been drunk or half drunk, but this got his attention. It says the king watched the hand as it wrote. So you can imagine, you're sitting in this room and all of a sudden a hand appears and starts writing, a disembodied hand, you know. I think the pastor made mention of, what was it, the Adams family thing was a hand. Well, that's kind of interesting. So anyway, the hand appears. And so what's the king do? Verse 6. His face turned pale, and he became so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. I think it's clear from this verse or I won't say clear. You can infer from this verse that the king knew he had crossed the boundary in bringing those goblins in. He knew that he had done something he shouldn't have done, and this was going to be not something good for him. And I think that's why he was afraid. That's why he was pale. And I think that's why he felt the way he did. So you can just imagine. So the hand goes up and writes. So what does he do? So the hand finishes. The words are there. He can't read the words. So what does he do? He calls for his wise men, the enchanters, the astrologers, diviners, Chaldeans, if you will, and says to them what they always say. Whoever reads this writing and tell me what it means will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Now, third highest ruler gives us some information because Nabonidus was the king. He was the king junior, if you will. So he was acting king in Babylon. So this would have been the ruler right under him, the third in line. He doesn't know Nabonidus has already been captured by Cyrus, king of Persia. But he's making a person who can give this right under him, next highest in the kingdom. Big honor, you know, for these people. So what does he do? He calls them all. They all come in. And it says they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. Now, this is interesting to me because I don't know what language they wrote in. In the biblical, the original biblical information we have, it's written in Aramaic or Syriac, which is translatable. But I don't know whether it was written in Syriac because the Babylonians could read Syriac or Armenian. It wasn't written in Chaldean, or they could have read that. Wasn't written in Persian, they could have read that. So I don't know whether it was just they didn't understand it was cryptic, or what it meant. But it's kind of interesting to me that when God writes, it may take a prophet of God to understand what he means. Although it ought to be fairly clear, you know, when you see the translation, you'll understand. So they couldn't tell the king what it meant. And because of that, he became even more afraid. He became more terrified. His face grew more pale, and his nobles were all baffled. They didn't have the fear that he had, and they were just confused. He was afraid. He was really almost, you could almost say he's about ready to pass out. Then something very interesting happens, and it's interesting in the fact that you wouldn't think this would be to happen, but when you understand a little bit about what comes next, you'll understand why it happened the way it did. Yes.
And what do you think at that point he's sober?
Well, he's had the equivalent of a few cups of coffee, I'm sure. He's awake. He's awake anyway. So what happens is all this commotion is going on in the banquet hall, but the queen is not in there. You'd think the queen would be his wife and would be in there with all of the wives and the concubines and the noble, but she's not. She's outside. And she hears all this commotion, and she comes to the banquet hall. She sees him, and she just walks in. Now, we know from other stories, Esther and other stories, that queens don't just walk in on kings. You know, they have to be announced. He has to raise his scepter to allow them to come in. I mean, this is a formal setting, okay? But she just walks in. And she says, may the king live forever. You know, butter him up for just a second. Don't be alarmed and don't look so pale. Yeah, you look terrible. You know, I can just see it now. It's like when I get up, luckily Vicky was not totally awake this morning. So when I left, she didn't say, are you wearing that? Which I know always means go change something. So this queen comes in, and she's talking to this king. So you know something's different right away. And what they believe is she was the queen mother, not the queen herself. She was the queen mother. And whether she was married as one of the wives of Nebuchadnezzar or Nabonidus, I don't know. But she's clearly a queen mother. And queen mothers, if you know, in royal circles, have a lot of freedom. They can do a lot of things. They don't rule, but they can stick their nose in places that most people couldn't. And she does. And she talks to him like he's a son or a grandson, not like he's the king and she's his, you know, subservient queen. So it's kind of interesting. And I think that's kind of, we kind of read through it because we don't see those relationship issues the same way they did, you know, with the king and the queen. The protocols were all pretty special. So she says, don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, or in the time of your ancestor, let's say, he was found to have insight, intelligence, and wisdom like that of the gods. So this is a voice from the past. This is somebody who recognizes what happened in Babylon 30 years ago. You know, now there's been a succession of kings. This guy probably didn't even know Daniel. You'll see in a minute he didn't know Daniel. And so, you know, it's like, it's almost like you would think if something profound happened, they would remember it. The kings would remember it. But like so many situations of power, power and time tend to elevate arrogance and elevate a discount of the past. You know, we don't learn in America, we don't learn anywhere, you know, that the past has clues for us. If we'll pay attention, they give us a lot of insight, but no, we just blunder on and do the things we want to do. And we get caught, you know, history does repeat itself, unfortunately, and that's cliche, but it's true. And in this case, she's trying to stop history from repeating itself. So she comes in and says, hey, you don't remember this. She didn't say that, but he doesn't remember it. There's a guy in the kingdom who can help you. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, your relative, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. And I'll say this again. I said it early in this. Daniel made a huge impact on these wise men. And these wise men are considered to be the same group of the wise men that came during the birth of Christ. These wise men were part of this group of wise men. They're called magi. That's another term for a magician or wise men. And so they're called magi. They're not kings, but they're high potentates, if you will, from Persia or other places. So Daniel has a very continuing profound effect on them. And I don't know whether it's because of all of this. I think it has to do with this and the fact of what's going to happen after this. So your father appointed him to be chief of all those people. He did this because Daniel, again, they don't call him Belteshazzar here, call him Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind, knowledge, understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. I mean, that's an endorsement, isn't it? That's an endorsement from a pagan queen of Daniel. So Daniel, out of his 70 or 75 years, has lived a pretty profound life in Babylon, according to the will of God, and followed the dictates of God. And that has been appreciated by some, but not all. And so in this case, she says to him, call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. A little pressure on Daniel here, but so what does the king do? The king calls him. He says, so, which means, in other words, Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father, the king, brought from Judah? He didn't know him. And how interesting it is. I mean, that was the same thing, you know, that happened over in Egypt, you know, when Jacob was over there, not Jacob, Joseph, when Joseph was, Joseph? Yeah, Joseph was over there. And you know, after a while, the pharaohs forgot about him, didn't know who he was. And that's the same thing here, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know, time heals all wounds. We've got a lot of little sayings we use for those things. One of the other sayings we have, by the way, and I should have said this earlier, is if somebody says to you, well, I guess they've seen the writing on the wall, or, well, she finally sees the writing on the wall, You know, that's part of our normal language today. And it all comes from this chapter of Daniel. And what does it mean? It generally means something very obvious has been written on the wall that if we read it and understand it, it will alter our course. It will be a prediction of something that's going to happen. And in this case, that's true. So, but I would suggest to you, most people understand the metaphor, but they don't understand where it came from. And they can apply it, but they don't really realize it's a biblical saying. And it really has to do with God calling people to account and giving them one final warning of what's going to happen. I should have done that earlier when we did the writing on the wall, but we haven't gotten to what the writing is yet. So he says, I've heard you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult writings. If you can read this writing, tell me what it means. You'll be clothed in purple. You'll be given a golden necklace and you'll be made first highest in the kingdom. Well, Daniel's 80 years old right now. He's kind of retired from being a chief magician, so to speak. And he's probably living quietly doing, you know, what he would do. I don't know what his physical health is like, but, you know, he's kind of resurrected here in a minute. So what does Daniel say? Let me get down here. Then Daniel answered the king, not impolitely, by the way. It may look a little brusque here, but he says, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. In other words, I'm not going to do this for rewards. I don't need the rewards. But nonetheless, I will tell you what the writing is and tell you what it means. So he says he'll do it, but he doesn't want all the glory for it. And he says, your majesty. Now, remember before when he gave the bad news to Nebuchadnezzar, he was nervous about giving it to him. And Nebuchadnezzar said, don't be worried. Just tell me what it says. And he did. And then he said, Daniel says, oh, king, oh, great king, if this was just for your enemies and not you. He doesn't do any of that. He just bluntly tells him. Now, what this tells me is that Daniel was pretty ticked off at the king for doing what he did with the goblets. And he thought it was a desecration of the holy things of Israel. And so he's just going to give it to him straight. He says, your majesty, the Most High gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. He's going to give him a little lecture first. Then he's going to tell him what it means. Because of the high position he gave him, the high position that God gave the king, all nations and people dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. That's the turning him into an animal and making him eat grass for 7 years. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys, ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets them over anyone he wishes. Now you remember from chapter 4, finally, after 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar looks up and he acknowledges God, and God restores his kingdom, gives him back his throne, and gives him peace and security for another 25 years.
Yeah. Verse 20, we can see that happening many, many times in our life today.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and you know, people that are blessed sometimes will accept the blessing, acknowledge God for the blessing. Sometimes they don't acknowledge God. But then sooner or later, they will begin to think, you know, I'm pretty good. I did this by myself. That couldn't have been God. That was just an accidental fate, you know, and I'm going to, you know, be puffed up and I'm going to be proud and I'm going to do all that. And God has a way of bringing people to heal, I guess.
Parts of the population, but we see it many times in our political world where people have been in power for years.
Oh, in power for years and they're puffed up and all that kind of stuff. I think that's right. I think the jokes are beginning to get pretty pointed now about, you know, the Senate being the memory care facility of the U.S. you know, for all the senators that are there who can't find their way out of the paper bag. And so, you know, we joke about that, but it's real visible. It's real visible. And it was real visible here, and all the people knew it. Remember, he proclaimed to all the people in chapter 4 what happened to him, why it happened, how he turned his life around. So it was a public document for them. Yeah, Glenn.
He will for sure eventually get to it.
Oh, he will. He will. Some sooner than others. And so, you know, he makes that point. He says he was driven away, and the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms, or sets him over anyone he wishes. And then he says, but you. Remember, always the little transitional phrases are important here. You know, did you have something, Bruce, you wanted to say? Yeah, he saw the writing on the wall. This is where it comes. This is where it comes from. It says, but you, Belshazzar, his son, his descendant, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Which is, that's pretty interesting to me. And we can look at the history of our nation as a Christian nation, and we can dismiss all that and try to put it out of our consciousness today as we move to be more secular than we've ever been before. But that's not history. That's not the way it was. That's not the way our ancestors saw it. And we should know that. We should know that. But we willfully are ignorant of many of those things. And so that's kind of it. He says, instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. So he's positioned himself against God. And then he nails him. You have the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, your concubines drank wine from them. And if that wasn't bad enough, then you praise the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which cannot see or cannot hear. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways.
Going back to Solomon, being careful about owning his cattle and all of the things that he had, we have to do the same thing. We not look at these things that we get.
Well, and you remember Nebuchadnezzar got up on the roof and he said, boy, am I really a smart king. You know, I've built this beautiful facility. It's got all these hanging gardens. You know, I'm king of the world. And that's the kind of, and God said, took him 10 years, but God said, not so fast, and humbled him. You see it in one chapter, but it took time for that to happen. So we see this, and then he says to him, therefore, God sent the hand that wrote the inscription. So I don't know whether it was God's hand or whether it was just the hand. But anyway, the net of it is God sent a final warning for him, really more of a declaration than a warning, a judgment. And so let's take a look at what happens. Here's the inscription that was written. I put it in a different font just to make it a little more visible. But if you look in your Bible, the terms may be a little different. Many, many Tycho Parson, or Eupharson may be the way your Bible translates it. And again, this is written in Aramaic, so it was understandable in our text, but I don't know what the language on the wall was. And then Daniel says, and here is what these words mean. Mene means God has numbered your days of your reign and brought it to an end. Now, he repeats that twice, which to me says, numbered the days, concluded the work. Number of the days brought it to an end. Many, many. Tikal means weighed. So your kingdom has been weighed and found short, found lacking, found wanting. And therefore, Parson, Perez, Eupharson, however you want to pronounce it, means your kingdom is divided. So it's divided and given to the Persians. That's the Parson part of it. Divided and given to the Persians. So God has brought his scale. He's weighed you and he's weighed everything about you, and you have been found negligent and wanting. And therefore, because of that, his judgment is that he's going to divide your kingdom and give it away. to the Persians. So this is the judgment. This is the beginning of the end for the Babylonian kingdom. And I'm running out of time, so I'll finish pretty quickly here. So now what? At Belshazzar's command, Daniel's given the royal robe, given the gold necklace, and proclaimed third highest in the kingdom. Daniel couldn't care less because this kingdom was about to go away. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, you wonder why 62 was mentioned. Well, 62 gives us a clue as to how to date when this happens. And so that's why it's in there. Nobody cares whether he was 62, but it does give us a clue to how to date this. Now, you say, well, Babylon was impervious. Well, was it? Here's what happened. The Persians stationed themselves on both sides of the river, and they dug a canal, and they diverted the river. So the river under the walls went down. And if all the army hadn't been celebrating inside at the feast, drinking wine, eating the fine food, somebody would have noticed it, but nobody noticed it. So the water went down, the Persians waded into the river, went under the tunnel, came up on the inside, and captured and killed, the king. So Babylon was taken that way. Again, there's some eerie parallels, to what we see in Israel today. But of course, God is in control of this, and God is in control of Israel. As I said in my note, the God who holds Israel in his hand neither slumbers nor sleeps. So Israel is protected by God. And we see finally in the end, Israel cannot protect themselves, and God steps in and does the work, in the war of Gog and Magog. Another story, but so we see all of that. And so what does it mean, and what happens to Daniel? Well, the first empire, now Babylon, has gone away. So the first prophecy has now come true. The Medo-Persian Empire, the arms and silver, have now come to be the world leader, of that time. And so that prophecy is coming true. And you wonder about Daniel, but does he survive? And he does. And the first two verses of chapter 6 tell us that. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps, again, which is a Persian word for princes, to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators. So he sets up three regions with three administrators, one of whom is Daniel. So obviously these soothsayers and all have gotten popular, and Darius takes time to hear the story, and he makes Daniel to be head of one of the big Persian empires. And that has a huge point going forward, because Daniel also has a huge thing to play in the Persian empire that comes. So I would just say to you, read chapter 6. It is the last of the history chapters in Daniel. And in chapter 7, we begin the apocalyptic or truly prophetic chapters. So this is more history. We get to the prophetic chapters in chapter 7. So read chapter 6. And chapter 6 is Daniel, the lion's den. So we'll get the second of the most famous children's stories here, Daniel, the lion's den.